If you want to bring your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 193. Happy Thanksgiving to you folks. Hope you have a good turkey day. For those of you listening outside of the United States, Thanksgiving is the day we celebrate where the... And I know people are going to argue with me about that. Some will say it's the imperial subjugation of the Native Americans, but frankly, it was the coming together of Native Americans and English settlers. At least that's the way it was taught in my... When in my youth at school, you know, it was celebrated as something important. And today, almost all Americans, regardless of race, religion, creed, all celebrate Thanksgiving in the United States with a giant meal that makes you sleepy at the end. So there's a few things on the technology front we want to talk to you about. So Apple has a, you know, just in the last, in October, they released the, or last month, they released the new Apple M1 Pro and M1 Max processors, which increase not only the cores, but the shared memory, and which is your RAM and your cache, and GPU cores, and it also has some AI cores and all this stuff built into an all-in-one SoC for their Macintosh line of products. Those have subsequently shipped since last, and those machines are amazing. The benchmarks on them are phenomenal. As a matter of fact, even to show something similar, Intel is having to show, and these are mobile chips from Apple. These are not desktop chips. They're having to show desktop chips that will not be released for an entire another year, beta chips, to even show benchmarks, and then they're having to tweak the benchmarks to make them look comparable because... you know, being mobile chips, Apple's benchmarks are based upon a certain level of performance at a certain number of watts. And the chips that Intel are showing have no limitation on how much power they can pull. Which also means that they're hotter and they do all kinds of stuff. And they're benchmarks on beta products, probably alpha products at this point. but one of the things that they've revealed is that, you know, the only part of the product line that they don't have an answer for yet is the Mac Pro, which is still using Intel Xeon chips. And so that's the last big piece in their roadmap to move to Apple Silicon. Whether that will be an M1 Pro or options in M1 Pro and M1 Max, but that can have a higher TDP or have more cores, we have yet to see, but it's something we probably will see early in 2022 calendar year 2022. Apple usually has an event sometime around January, February. That there's a good chance that they might talk about it then. Might wait until June when they have the Worldwide Developers Conference. Have yet to see, but it'll be pretty cool when they do. The M1 Max and M1 Pro chips are amazing. I can't say enough about how steady and stable for something that's brand new has come out that is not really an iteration of something prior. I mean, it's a little iteration of the M1, but there's a lot of modification there. Intel's 11th gen CPUs and their upcoming 12th gen, well, particularly their upcoming 12th gen, but some of the later 11th gen CPUs, in order to compete with the Apple M1 and a lot of these ARM-based SoCs, Intel has decided they would do the little big concept that ARM processors have been using for years now, which is we're going to have performance cores and we're going to have efficiency cores in their chips. Well, these new chips break a whole bunch of DRM on... a whole bunch of games, and there's 50 plus games that have been identified that are incompatible with the Alder Lake CPUs. Let's see what some of them are. According to the... And the reason is because the DRM looks at the CPU and it sees performance cores and it sees efficiency cores, And it goes, oh, that's two separate PCs. You need a separate license to run this on because of the digital rights management. Some games, they don't care. But there's over 51 games, including For Honor, Mortal Kombat 11, Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, and Shadow of the Tomb Raider, as well as Assassin's Creed Valhalla. Now, there is a workaround on Windows 10 and 11. 11 doesn't seem to have the issue as bad as Windows 10, but on Windows 10, if your motherboard supports it, you can go in the motherboard and you can disable the efficiency cores so everything runs on your performance cores only, and it basically tricks the DRM into letting you run the game. And some motherboards, I guess you can turn it on and off dynamically once you enable it in the BIOS. You can hit scroll lock and it'll turn off the efficiency cores, launch the game, and then kill the game when you're done and hit it again and you get your efficiency cores back. But man, that seems like a lot of work. It's one of those things that irritates me in the Intel Microsoft side of things, because that tells me that there's not a lot of collaboration being done with the hardware OEMs, with Microsoft and Windows, and the developers of all these games, including the developers of the DRM that these game companies are using. They should have known about this a year ago. They should have made patches and to make changes. We're still patchless at this point.
Now, here's the question that I pose to you as an outsider on this issue. Is that a Microsoft problem or is that a game developer problem?
I would say this is more of a game developer problem on this side. Because Microsoft, Windows 10, again, is not, it's the dead product for Microsoft. I mean, they're doing updates for the next 5 years, but they're mainly security updates. There's no feature functionality updates. The Windows 11 is the way forward. Windows 11 doesn't have a problem with the performance core, efficiency core. They were working with Intel and understand that. And part of the reason they did is because the companies who care about that, you know, the makers of professional work software, who've been working with Apple too, because Autodesk is one, because AutoCAD runs on the new Macs. It also runs on these Alder Lake CPUs from Intel. Photoshop or Adobe with the whole Creative Suite, those programs, they needed to understand that or they were going to have similar issues. Those programs don't use this Duendo or whatever it is, DRM, that a lot of the game developers buy their product and integrate it in. And because of that, that's the biggest issue, is these game developers didn't bother to check. Now, game developers are probably, how do I want to say this? They're the worst kind of developers ever, because they build stuff and they do a good job in the sense that they're building a game, but they make a lot of shortcuts. They're very resistant to fixing things if it doesn't cause a major glitch. I mean, there are games that have had third parties have done the patching, have made patches for games because the original developer just won't patch the game to fix some issue that affects thousands of customers. They're, you know, game developers and also game development teams, they're incentivized to either build the next version of the game or build a new game. You know, we've already sold the game. Game companies are, we've already sold the game. We have your money. We need to move to the next thing that's going to make you spend another $50, $60, $70, $80. You know, the problem with is twofold though in that industry. One of them is console gaming has gotten so good, and console gaming doesn't need all that DRM because you're kind of locked to the platform. You know, if you write a game, even if you write the same game and put it on the PlayStation that you're putting on the Xbox, you can't take the PlayStation game and throw it in the Xbox and it'll work. You know, it's different code. It's compiled differently, even if it's only downloadable content. So there's not like a third-party DRM that, you know, it's this affects PC gamers mostly. And that's why I think a lot of PC games don't get patched on a routine basis. The only ones that get patched routinely are the massively multiplayer games, which we're just not seeing that many. You know, that the World of Warcraft era is kind of, an EverQuest era is over. You know, it used to be every major franchise had
I'm actually surprised Star Trek Online is still online.
Well, you know, there's all kinds of things going on in the gaming industry. I wish Thomas were here to talk about it, because he could tell you in detail all the problems at Blizzard. I mean, they have social issues within their company culture that are causing issues with the games. They have game issues because World of Warcraft, which was their biggest moneymaker. I mean, I used to play World of Warcraft 18 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Starcraft, same deal. You know, I mean, that's another one of those.
Well,
same.
Starcraft, but Starcraft was never a massively multiplayer online game. World of Warcraft was, because you had Warcraft, you know, those were the late 90s games, and then they brought out, you know, so the first MMO I played, MMORPG, was Asheron's Call, which was actually a Microsoft game. And then Asheron's Call begat World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft begat EverQuest, which was actually the first one.
Yeah.
And EverQuest then begat Star Wars Online, which we played a lot of. Because they used the same gaming engine, but it was Star Wars and, you know, universe. And they did make some improvements in gameplay and stuff for that. But World of Warcraft is the only one that I know that's really been actively developed for almost 20 years. And not only actively developed, but actively developed on multiple platforms, you know. But the... they're having issues there because it's no longer the moneymaker. And so even they're having issues with, well, how much resources do we devote on maintaining the game versus building what's next?
Yeah.
You know, and that's where some of their social issues within the corporate culture are coming in too.
True.
But there's a lot of, evidently there's a lot of misogyny and things going on. And so there's a lot, they have settled like something like 17 lawsuits with some of the corporate execs over sexual harassment claims and everything.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty bad. And it's, misogyny has been a big issue in the gaming industry for a long time. And, but all of that's now coming to a head. You know, it's probably one of the better things that are coming out of the woke era of social cancel culture. But that being said, you know, this issue is something that has to be addressed because, you know, gamers, Intel, they make their money by selling processors, whether it's to individual gamers or to companies making servers. It's in their best interest that as many processors get sold. If they lose the gaming community, which... they've slowly been losing to companies like Steam and companies like AMD, because AMD processors have routinely been more powerful or at least as good, but a lot less expensive than the equivalent Intel processor for years. You know, that slowly eroded the gaming market that Intel, because Intel doesn't care. They sell processors in bulk to Dell and HP and the guys who make laptops. That kind of money, they don't really care about that level of processor unless it's for a mobile workstation or a workstation type thing. They care about the server processors because they want to maintain that market. But see, even there, they're having issues because NVIDIA is now building their own ARM processors to take over a lot of those high-performance loads. And when they get there, and the fact that Linux is the number one operating system for servers and not Windows, they're having a hard time keeping the industry from moving to something that is more energy efficient but just as powerful. Because these CIOs are looking at their data center costs and they're going, can I get an appreciable, you know, can I save an extra $1.5 million or $2 million? Or in some cases, some of these companies, can I save $1 billion? and electrical and air conditioning costs for, you know, my data centers across the world, they're going to move to that technology. I mean, it is what it is. So the gaming market provides quite a bit of boost because a lot of gamers, they buy the premium hardware as soon as it comes out because they want as many frames per second. So not only do they get that from the games, but they also get the, you know, they get it from the video card vendors. And you, and since Intel is supposed to release their standalone GPUs that compete with the AMD Radeons and the or RX series and the NVIDIA RX series. I don't think AMD's is called RX, but whatever it is, it's the 5000 series. But when they get those cards to market, they will then have a little bit better stand. But they were driven to do that because they were losing a lot of market share to companies who were fully integrated, meaning I can sell you a high-end GPU along with a high-end processor, you know? Now, that being said, the 11th gen Core i7s that I have that have the AVX 512 capability on them, and then also have the Intel Iris XR, whatever their newest Iris technology, as integrated chips with integrated graphics, it's fairly decent. I mean, from a gaming perspective, I'm not totally unhappy with them and and things, but I wouldn't have bought that for my gaming PCs. Both are one's a Ryzen 7 and one's a Ryzen 5, and they have dedicated GPUs in them from other vendors. so you know that's not what gamers are trying to compete for that market. So this is important for them. Because the other issue is from that perspective of not being ARM, they're kind of the first x86 manufacturer to go, well, we're going to do performance cores and efficiency cores. You know, we're going to, which means that the efficiency cores are not slow, but they run on a lot less power. And so, you know, all your tasks that don't require the very top end of performance are going to use those. So like word processing, email, you know, so it makes the PC more efficient, and it's very important in the mobile space where, you know, you want to have longevity and battery life on something, but still get really, really, really good performance. So let's move on to the next thing. I know Matt hasn't talked a lot about that.
Well, I'll pitch in where I can.
Yeah. Raspberry Pi is in the news again. Might be a good Christmas gift if you can get a hold of one. I was able to obtain one. But they have put out a new Raspberry Pi Zero 2W. It's 5 times faster than the original Raspberry Pi Zero W. And it only costs $5 more. They're magnificent little computers. You can build game consoles very easily out of them. you can... even use them for standard desktop tasks, although I find it a little tedious because they only have 512 megs of RAM on them, so you're competing for resources with the GUI. But they're great project PC, great for kids who are into technology, as we're going into the beginning of the Christmas season here. Probably the thing, Matt will have something to say on this. So, as Chromebooks, you know, Apple's kind of gave up the education market partly. They still are very competitive in the iPad space, but they gave up the Mac, using the Mac as the level of standard for education like they had in the 80s when they first brought machines out, 80s and early 90s. So Windows kind of took over because there was a lot of cheap Windows hardware, not because Windows was better, but just because it was cheap. And if schools slowly and education slowly digitized, that was an inexpensive way to get kids into the market. You know, if everybody remembers the old e-machines, you could go to Walmart and spend $500 and you get a full e-machine computer. And it would, for a year, it would be reasonably good for everything. And it included a monitor and everything. And then the next year you could go buy just a new processing box for like $350. It was still the low end, and that market still exists. I mean, it moved from desktop computers to laptops. You can go and buy, you know, these dirt cheap Celeron based Windows laptops, you know, for $200-$300, depending on what features and functionality you want, and you use them for a year. I know tons of people who that's how they live their lives, their digital lives.
That's how instead of going out and getting a new one every year, I run mine into the ground.
Yeah.
You know, and that's...
Well, I know a lot of people, they wait for the Black Friday sales, and they buy one. By the time that they get to the next November and the Black Friday sales, the one they had is... Because it was right on the edge of... Yeah. It was usable at the beginning or the last November, but it's not. It's really slow this November. They buy the next one for $200 or $300, you know, $199 to $299, and that's how they move everything along, because, you know, and they move their TurboTax files, and, you know, they get the free year of Office 365, and, you know, so they don't ever really subscribe to it, and that's how they move their things along. They don't do anything but surf the web and do email, and occasionally, you know, might need Word or Excel, but never need PowerPoint, you know, and, you know, and they might buy two or three, because they buy one for their kid for school, and they buy one. Well, then Chromebooks came along, and Chromebooks had a lot of advantages. There were not Chromebooks at the beginning were not well loved, but they were cheap. Go in, spend $99 instead of $199. You get a web-based OS. You had Google Docs, which was free and still is free. So you had an office suite. You had to be connected to the internet, but that wasn't such a big deal if you were at home. And then you could save all your stuff to Google Drive. But it was easy. You didn't have a lot of the headaches with Windows. You didn't have to update it. It didn't get slower over the year. But the downside of Chromebooks at that time was that all your apps were web-based. But there were a lot of people in a lot of schools who adopted it, because, again, if a school was making an investment, it made a lot of sense. Now, where the battle there was low-end iPads versus Chromebook, and they ate a lot of Apple's share in the iPad market, because at the time when Chromebooks kind of took off, the cheapest iPad was $499. Now, iPad, a really quality iPad today, is $329. So, and Chromebooks have slowly inched up. You can still get the $99 Chromebooks, but nobody wants that Chromebook.
Yeah, I was going to say that the ones that we just bought for work are like a $200 model.
Yeah, there's, I mean, you can buy Chromebooks that are $1,200 now.
That's
crazy. My uncle, because I got him to buy a $129 Chromebook, an Acer, a couple years ago at Black Friday, because I got tired of tech support. And he runs a Mac on his desktop, but it did everything he needed. And it was one of the models, the reason it was so cheap, it was one of the models that did not, because Chrome OS also now runs Android apps. And you have the Google Play Store, and you can put...
Right.
So Office 365, it can run on a Chromebook, and you can save files locally and everything else. You could do that too because they had some versions over the years. Google Docs had the offline version, which could also not only save to your Google Drive, but could save locally to storage and things like that. But a lot of the management headaches, you know, you don't ever have to update the Chromebook. It automatically updates all those things in the background. And because it's a very locked down system, it's hard to break it. You know, you can't, there's not many things to go in the settings and go tweak it, you know, and it won't boot anymore. It never does that. Right. And if it does, there's you take a pen and a reset hole on the bottom, and you poke it and hold it for 15 seconds. And when you reboot the Chromebook, guess what? You just put your Google name back in, and all of a sudden you're back to operating condition. But he just bought like he bought an open box, but it was like a $400 Chromebook, but it has a 15.6 display on it. It's an Asus. It's really nice. And it has for a Chromebook, I think it has 128 gigs of storage. It's built on a Celeron. But that's the thing. A Celeron or an ARM-based one, low-end ARM-based chip, the Chromebooks, they don't typically get slow. I mean, it takes years of updates before they get to the point where it's like, man, this is really slow. Because my first Chromebook was one of the early Samsungs. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 years later that it was like, oh, running Chrome OS on this thing really sucks. And so, I mean, he'll get his money out of it. You know, he'll probably have it for the next 4 or 5 years and then update it again. And it does what he needs. He watches a lot of YouTube while he's working. And that's what he wanted it for. And, and you know, and also Chromebooks now have touch screens and all this stuff. But, and they're, Apple's gaining their share back now with the $329 iPad versus the Chromebook. And a lot of that has to do with service and support. You know, you can pay $3 a month for as long as you have the iPad and you have AppleCare support. So you break the screen, it's only $79 to go in and have. And essentially what they did, they don't repair the screen at the Apple store. They give you a brand new iPad.
Yeah.
You know? And you don't get that with Chromebooks, even the more expensive ones. But that being said, Microsoft is now going, well, where's that part of our business? So I took a 10-minute trek around the world to tell this story. But so they've now, so we have Windows in S mode, which was originally supposed to be the Chrome killer. So you buy hardware, Windows is in S mode, you're limited in what you can do and what app, you could only install apps from the App Store. And a lot of people didn't like it, largely because it was Windows, and you were still, even though you were buying a low-end Windows device, you were still paying, you know, $300 or $400, and then you come find out you can't, you know, I can't install TurboTax from TurboTax's website that I already have a subscription to. I have to rebuy it through the App Store, or I can turn off S mode, which was free, but then it turns it into Windows Home. And I mean, every S mode device I've ever owned end up, within 3 or 4 days, I end up turning it into Windows Home, because there's stuff I want to load, you know, utilities and everything else. And I don't typically buy low end stuff, but you know, buying a Microsoft Surface and it's in S mode, and I'm like, I can't install my CD burning application. You know, we're going to Microsoft Home. So they now have this new version for SE. They've released, Microsoft has released a $250 Surface Laptop SE. And I will admit, Surface hardware, if you can afford it, is typically some of the best Windows machines you'll ever have. Partly because Microsoft doesn't put crapware on their own machines. So you don't have to go through that process of uninstalling all these utilities that you don't want. And everything. So, but SE is their answer to Microsoft, to Microsoft's answer to Chrome OS. So I'll read you a little article. This is from Ars Technica. So Microsoft's answer to Chrome OS is Windows 11 SE. Unlike past efforts like Windows in S mode, which is still its own separate thing, Windows 11 SE isn't just a regular version of Windows with a cheaper license or a cut-down version that runs fewer apps. Windows 11 SE defaults to saving all files, including user profile information, to students' OneDrive accounts, and it has had some standard Windows 11 features removed to ensure a distraction-free learning environment that performs better on low-end devices. The operating system also gives IT administrators exclusive control over the apps and browser extensions that can be installed and run via Microsoft Intune. Now, that being said, I love how Ars said that, you know, things that take away distractions or make performance better, all those things that were removed were to make performance better on a low-end machine, which I can appreciate. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see, because a Surface at that level is going to be a premium device compared to most Chromebooks at $250. It'll be interesting. I might pick one up just to look at it, because I'm assuming you... They're also looking at marketing this not just to schools, but to people who want that Chrome-like experience but want to use Windows. Now, what's going to be interesting is you can't image a Windows 11 SE machine. You can't download and install Windows SE and purchase and install Windows 11 SE on hardware that will support it. And if you change the OS on the device, you can't get, you can't put Windows SE 11 SE back on it. So they're trying for the model like the ARM version of Windows 11 or and in Windows 10, which is unless you buy a device that already has it on it, you can't get it, which I think is very short-sighted in Microsoft's point. Because every person that I, in my family, who uses a Windows machine and refuses to look at Chrome or macOS, something that is much easier for me to maintain from a distance, I would put on Windows 11 SE. I would. Because most of them, all they're doing is surfing the web and checking email and occasionally using Word or Excel. And I could make easily make exceptions so that they could install, you know, like TurboTax and Quicken if they needed them. But to have something that's a little more resilient to people screwing them up all the time, because Windows is terrible about that. You know, they go in and even walking tech support through the phone or using an RDP session and going into their machine, you know, it's just a terrible, there's way too many options and you can't turn them off. And if you limit somebody's machine remotely to an administrator account, they're calling you constantly to do stuff. You know, I can't install X. This browser extension isn't working. Yeah. What's the, you know? And so I think this could be a boon for Microsoft, frankly. Not only will you see a boom in you know, these low-end cheap devices because people are going to buy them, but also people overall might be happier with them because they're more of an appliance as opposed to a full-blown computer. Because most people aren't like me and run Logic or Photoshop or Final Cut Pro or DaVinci. You know, there are people who surf the web and watch YouTube and check their email and occasionally use TurboTax once a year and occasionally use Excel and Microsoft Word, probably Word more than anything. That's why I think Microsoft ought to split Office up and give Word away for free. Get rid of WordPad and just include Word, the full version of Word, on every machine. Because every other operating system, even paid operating system, gives you a full suite, Office suite. You got LibreOffice on Linux. Apple gives iWork away for free. And iWork is a excellent operating system. And both, or operating system, Office suite. And both LibreOffice and iWork will save Microsoft formats in its native format with almost no issues with translation or anything else. That's my opinion. And you know what they say about opinions.
Like a-holes, everyone has one.
That's right. So it was interesting. So, you know, we talked about in one of our previous episodes about the new Ford Maverick.
Yes.
And it's really innovative. It's innovative not only from a technology standpoint, but it's innovative from a marketing and distribution standpoint from Ford. So not long after that, the Ford Maverick article came out that did a review on Ford Maverick from Inverse. Talked about some of the, you know, a lot of the innovations that the marketing material on Ford's website doesn't talk about. Consumer Reports put out a road report, and they're saying, you know, right now in the particularly in the United States, there's a small truck revolution going on because a Maverick is smaller than a Ford Ranger. And the number one in this revolution, they talk about the Ford Maverick. I did not realize that if you buy the top end base model, it's only $10,000 more than the low end base model, which is a complete truck. So a fully, you know, if you buy the XLT package, which is the better tires, the better interior and trim package and all that, you instead of $19,995, which I find is amazing in a new vehicle, not only new but a hybrid new vehicle.
Yeah.
Their high-end model is only $29,880. Consumer Reports put all of that in there. But there are other players who are trying to play in this market too. None of them are in that price band that Ford and the Maverick are, which I think will make them very successful. But Hyundai put out the Santa Cruz. That's their new subcompact truck, is what I guess I'm going to call them. It's actually a pretty cool looking truck. All these trucks have a 4.5 foot bed, which is, you know, for most people, even a farmer, most of the time I don't need a 6.5 foot or an 8 foot bed truck. I just don't. But I do need one that has at least a 4 foot bed, and all these are 4.5 foot beds. But the Santa Cruz, it's kind of nice. It is definitely stylish. But it comes in that $23,990, which I don't think is terrible, particularly for a foreign-made vehicle. But it tops out at almost $40,000.
So here's my question about the marketing for these vehicles. Are they still trying to appeal to your eco-weenies?
No.
Or are they finally getting around to saying, here's a beefy little truck that'll just be a workhorse
so
for you?
The Maverick is like 281 horsepower. The Santa Cruz says it's a 281 horsepower, 2.5 liter turbocharged engine, and allows it to tow up to 5,000 pounds. I mean, these are real. The inverse review, they said, you know, this truck is amazing, and it should appeal to farmers all the way, or from soccer moms to farmers. You know, it's a truck that's built to do real work, but also be able to haul enough people around and things like that. And I would say the Santa Cruz, the issue I have with a lot of the Japanese and Korean vehicles versus everybody's making their stuff out of plastic, but they tend to have more plastic gewgaws on them that can be broken. And they're harder, you know, those things, if you want the truck to look nice and stay nice, those trim pieces are much more expensive to replace than if you bought a domestic one. Because there's also the Nissan Frontier, which starts at $28,000 and goes to $37,000. My stepfather actually just bought one of these new Nissan Frontiers. It's very plasticky with a lot of gewgaws. I mean, it's an okay truck. It has a 310 horsepower V6, where the other two are four cylinders. The Maverick is cool because it's a hybrid, which these other two are not. So it gets like 40 miles to the gallon in the city as a pickup truck. You know, and it still has 281 horsepower out of a four cylinder engine. But you know, there's a lot of good reviews on that Nissan Frontier. Again, I think it's a little plasticky. I don't like the bed configuration as well, but it does have built-in rails that you can get locking pieces. The thing that where Ford I think has done the best part, not only in the price range, it has a ton of drink holders, and those drink holders are made to hold like your Yeti bottles and things, which are thermos or whatever, which farmers tend to use, which construction workers tend to use, which soccer moms tend to use, you know. And they have lots of cup holders. There's like 18 cup holders in a Ford Maverick.
That seems a bit excessive.
Well,
for
if you compare that to the Mazda 5, which is an SUV, that they, you know, which also cost, I think base models cost twice as much. There's two cup holders. And I think that's a response to that, because that's always been a complaint with some of these, you know, SUV makers, is that we're building a vehicle that to haul people, and you're putting two cup holders in the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know? And, but I think for me personally, a truck is more practical than an SUV. I think there's probably a middle ground, you know, and I don't think they're trying to, in Ford's case, they're not trying to cater to the eco-weenie population. they're trying to move their product line forward to the point where, you know, government regulation seems to be going.
Well, I guess what the point I was trying to make with the marketing was, you don't call a truck a Maverick and then turn around and have all the advertising be geared towards the eco weaning.
Yeah, I agree. But you know, it's kind of funny as you see Ford moving. You know, Ford makes trucks and the Mustang. The only car they make is the Mustang. They make trucks. The Maverick traditionally was a car model that they made from the late 60s through the 70s. And it was a muscle car, as a matter of fact, you know.
Well, and again, that's my point.
And so I think
we're at a point where if we're going to want these vehicles to take off, we have to start realizing that the crowd that needs to buy them and buy into the technology is not the eco weenies, because they already bought their
Priuses.
Prius.
Yeah. No, I agree with you there. I've extensively looked at the Maverick because that's what I'm saving money to buy. I have not bought many new vehicles. I have bought a couple in my lifetime. And part of that is because almost no new vehicle is worth the money. The day you drive it off the lot is worth the money you just paid for it, you know, 15 minutes before. The Maverick, and I, like you are with computers, I am with vehicles. I drive them until the wheels fall off.
Well, I'm similar with cars, too. Did you know that?
Yeah. but you know, so if I buy a Maverick, to me, I've never been, I mean, Nissan tried to get in the bigger truck market, and they built a 3/4-ton truck, but they built it like they built their, you know, what I call the suburban weenie truck buyers, you know, the people who buy these trucks that sit up real high, and they buy them out of this sense of machismo, so that they can, you know, they never haul a load in them, but they park them in their driveway at their subdivision.
But that's like the truck that's got the fancy molding and all of that.
Oh, yeah.
That's not who this market really needs.
Well, it's kind of funny, you know, Chevy and Ford trucks, I prefer Ford, but Chevy makes a really good truck. Dodge makes a kind of middle-of-the-road truck, but still better, in my opinion, than most of the Japanese trucks out there. Except for, like, the old Toyota Pups and stuff like that, you know, they were selling around the world. Those were built really well, but they were totally bare. I mean, you're lucky that there was a fan in them, you know, to blow air, circulate air in the cab on some of those trucks. Those are really cool, but they quit making those in the mid-80s, you know? But, you know, as far as real workhorses, the trucks that get bought by as fleet vehicles for construction companies and commercial agriculture and everything, it's Ford and Chevy. The only reason they have high-end trim and interior packages on those trucks is for people like me who work in the horse industry, and we live in our truck. We're hauling horses, you know, from Ohio to Oklahoma or from Ohio to Alabama and back. It's more about the luxury of I'm living in this truck, you know, for 10, 20-hour car ride, not because I want something fancy to impress my neighbors with. Because typically the Lariat models of like Ford vehicles, the outsides don't look any different than a non-Lariat model or even just a base model. It's the inside that's totally different. You know, they'll have bucket seats that are leather with seat heaters and all that. And, you know, your fleet vehicles typically have a bench seat with a fold-down armrest and, you know, they're vinyl. But Ford makes their money on fleet vehicles.
Right. Well, and that's
And so does Chevy in that market, yeah. But that's why I thought it was funny when Nissan put out this 3/4-ton truck, and I'm like, I would never haul anything with that, because if I accidentally had the, you know, jackknife the trailer and bump the bumper against the trailer, it's going to break the truck. Yeah, they were pretty on the inside and had all these gewgaws and all this stuff, but it's like, do I sound like an old man now? Gewgaws, thingamajigs. But you know, that's a difference in that market, and I see that between the Maverick and like the Nissan Frontier. Nissan Frontier, it's a nice vehicle, but it's for soccer moms. It's not for people who are really going to do anything with it. I mean, and it's funny because you pay the people who are buying the Nissan Frontiers and I have not seen the Santa Cruz in person. It might be better because I actually have a higher opinion of the Korean-made vehicles than I do of a lot of the Japanese-made vehicles. Part of that is because the Korean cars are trying to move up in the market, and the Japanese vehicles have been there since the 80s, and so they're like General Motors. They're fat, dumb, and happy. But, you know, they spray the bed. They put bed liner in them, which you would do with any pickup truck. But if you never use the bed, you know?
Yeah.
And I also think it's strange. It's hard to... One of the things that's really hard, particularly, like, because they make the shape of the Nissan Frontier and the Santa Cruz, it's kind of a unibody, so the cab kind of sweeps into the bed as opposed to being a separate bed and a cab.
Yeah.
It's hard to get like toppers and things for them or tonneau covers because they don't fit.
Yeah.
Whereas Ford built the Maverick so that not only can you buy those accessories from them, but you can either make them. They're offering plans on their website to build like bike. You can buy a bike rack, which the reviewers have said is phenomenal because it's an in-bed bike rack on a 4.5 foot bed.
Nice.
But they said they give you the plans to build one yourself, and they give you plans to build features that are 3D models that you can download and 3D print to use in the bed of your truck with the rail system. Nissan, you'd think some of these Japanese companies would really be, and Korean companies would be into that technology piece, because as a society, more of them are probably going to do it than people who buy trucks in the United States.
Right.
So, you know, like I said, it's a big difference in marketing. But with the exception of the continent of Africa, I don't think there's, and the outside of the United States, there's not a huge market for South America, definitely. Outside of North America and South America and Africa, the rest of the world doesn't have a big use for trucks. You know, in Europe, particularly England, I think I saw one pickup truck, and I covered the entire south of England, you know, going through farms and everything else. And that whole area, they just don't use those type of vehicles. They tend to actually use more of an SUV type vehicle. You find a lot of Land Rovers on farms.
Right.
Because they need a four-wheel drive vehicle, but they don't haul loads of stuff like we do in the United States. But then again, you're talking about a country who's about the size of some of our states. You know. So let's move on to the next. I love talking about cars. Well, trucks. And I like putting down General Motors just because it irritates Sean. So, I guess one of the issues that they're having, you know, as we're starting to fly the Dragon crew module from SpaceX on more regular missions... They're still having issues with the toilets on the zero grav toilets on the Dragon Endeavour capsule. Said on their return trip from the International Space Station, they had to having to use nappies because there's some issues with the vehicle's toilets. They'll get that worked out. I mean, NASA wasn't perfect either. As a matter of fact, all of our Apollo astronauts had to wear nappies.
In there, you're talking about whole missions.
Yeah, whole missions.
Rather than, you know, the ride up, go to the space station, hang out for a few days, and then, you know, 2-3 hours back, you know. You can't hold it for 2 or 3 hours.
So, evidently, this is, you know, this is something that SpaceX needs to work on, because it's been a recurring problem. According to the article, this is actually from news.com, not Australia. It says that malfunctioning toilets have been a recurring problem for SpaceX's Crew Dragon capsules during a four-person all-civilian space flight named Inspiration 4, the first of its kind to feature no professional astronaut. A tube which funneled urine into a storage tank disconnected and leaked into the fan.
Oh, wow.
There's a storage tank where the urine goes to be stored, and there's a tube that came disconnected or came unglued. That allowed urine essentially to not go into the storage tank, but essentially go into the fan system. Although those on board did not notice, officials found that urine had collected into an enclosed area beneath the capsule's floor once it returned after a three-day orbit in September. When we got the vehicle back, we looked under the floor and saw the fact that there was contamination under the floor of Inspiration 4. And it says the leak was also detected in two additional Dragon capsules, including the spacecraft set to return in the coming days. And this article is from this is from November 6th, so that capsule's already back. But, you know, when you go back and you look at the history of the Apollo missions and stuff, they had all kinds of issues there.
Well, because every mission has at least one glitch of significant.
But I'm more impressed with the fact that urine leaked into a system, it didn't affect the astronauts, and it didn't cause any other malfunctions.
Right.
You know, that's a well-built system. I mean,
did you follow that Inspiration 4 mission?
A little bit. I didn't follow it completely. I was working on a proposal during that time, so there was that and the William Shatner Blue Origin thing I was vaguely aware of. I think it's cool that Bill Shatner went up, basically becoming the oldest person to ever be in space. But I don't appreciate, and I know Bill Shatner is huge egotist. I mean, I've met him in person several times. It's all about him.
Right.
But I don't think, I think there's been a lot of sour grapes between like George Takei and some of the other folks who are still alive, because they've been making fun of him, you know, about going up into space. And I'm like,
but you know what though? I found him to be extraordinarily
humbled for doing that. I know.
Throughout that whole process, he was not the Bill Shatner of old. I would think the George Takeis of the world would mind their helm. But
yeah, I agree. So kind of funny, something that happened, I think this article is from today. It's from Ars Technica, but there is a company called Spin Launch that is created a way, they've built a centrifuge in a vacuum that can fling a payload into orbit and break Earth's gravity. Now, I imagine it would have to be something incredibly, incredibly precise, because your speed, and they would have to understand, wind resistance and wind and everything, but to be able to fling something from the ground into orbit. And that's what it's designed for, this company. It's a startup. But, you know, the idea is that instead of using fossil fuels and stuff to put small satellites and things in space, we can use this centrifuge and launch them up, up there without spending rocket fuel. And this is another innovation to me in the space industry that somebody has just overlooked, kind of like, you know, hey, we can land a rocket on its butt end and reuse this thing. You know, Boeing and them, this is not a new idea.
Boeing just wanted to keep selling rockets.
Correct.
You know, I mean, reusable technology didn't help their bottom line.
So here's what Ars Technica has to say about Spin Launch. They completed their first test flight. It says the California-based startup uses kinetic energy to launch payloads, and its test projectile reached tens of thousands of feet during its first launch. The company's method uses a vacuum-sealed centrifuge to spin the rocket to a velocity several times the speed of sound before it is released. It's a radically different way to accelerate projectiles and launch vehicles to hypersonic speeds using a ground-based system.
my fear with this.
Well, so the downside of it is one, it could be used as a weapon system.
That's what I was going to say. This is a doomsday machine right here.
The other part of it, too, is that if you're spinning something that fast, it's like a railgun.
Yeah.
You know, you're hyper-accelerating something that, multiple times the speed of sound. What if something goes wrong? What if the rocket is not reinforced enough and it breaks up? You know, you then have, you know, there's some things that they need to answer.
That's before you get to like throwing up billion-dollar satellites. You're going to test that technology with, you know, the technological equivalent of Ham the Chimp.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's what this first test flight was for.
Right.
And, you know, what I don't know about it is, you know, is there centrifuge vertical so that it swings it like this and then it launches it, you know, in a straight off the earth as opposed to trying to shoot over an angle? I mean, because there might be efficiencies doing it that way, but if you shoot it over an angle, that means there's also that there's more potential for it to be a weapon than it is.
Well, I think there's potential either way, but
there is. It says that it's a spinning and winning. The company completed its first major test using a 1/3 scale version of its accelerator on October 22nd at Spaceport America in New Mexico. Even so, this version of the accelerator stands 165 feet tall. By using this approach, Spin Launch aims to build smaller rockets that require less fuel to reach orbit. Its first orbital vehicle is intended to loft about 200 kilograms to low Earth orbit. Spin Launch has raised $110 million to date from investors, including Kleiner Perkins, Google Ventures, Airbus Ventures, and others. I mean, they got big names backing them. And, but, you know, that what I like about this is competition to SpaceX in competition to Blue Origin and some of these other companies who are, you know, like, you know, part of the reason SpaceX exists is to put their constellation of internet satellites in orbit, in low Earth orbit. This could do the same thing. Maybe this is more economic or can be more economical, can be more ecologically friendly. You know, so it may, you know, maybe they become the UPS of putting satellites in orbit.
Or at least DHL.
Yeah. Yeah. Virgin is launching their third mission of 2021. Let's see. This mission will carry both experimental satellites for the Department of Defense as well as two nanosatellites for Polish company Sat Revolution. And I think that's interesting too, is now we're seeing a space business come out, you know. And while I consider Virgin more of a niche player, it's more of, yeah, I have a billionaire and I have lots of money. You know, the fact that he's trying to make a go of it and make it profitable by being FedEx.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that,
and, you know, that'll be interesting, too. Going back to the U.S. Postal Service thing we talked about in a previous episode. Is it'll be interesting to see if low orbit space vehicles will start bringing cargo, because if you can get it up into low orbit, it makes it very easy to do fly longer distances across the world.
That's another innovation.
Yeah.
Of well, like we were talking about, using more and more cargo planes over passenger aircraft. If you could find a way to safely and more cost-effective usage of space systems, that, I think, is another innovation in the shipping space.
Yeah. So, lastly but not least, partly because my MacBook Pro is running out of juice, China's space program is aiming to build a 1 kilometer space station. Part of this is a marketing thing for China. You know, hey, we built the first real space station.
Are they saying ISS is not a real space station?
Well, big space station. You know, one where you could put hundreds of people in orbit as opposed to five or six. And, but more significantly, the scientific community believes that the reason they're doing it is because if you do the math, in order to build something for a longer term occupancy and longer term space missions, you need to build about a kilometer long space station so that you can do spin-induced artificial gravity.
Right.
And so that not only is this, they want to mark from a marketing perspective, we're the first to do it. They're testing this so that they can test their own missions to Mars, because they'll build a spacecraft that's a kilometer long. Well, it's really a kilometer wide, so that they can spin it
right.
And overcome a lot of the problems, like muscle loss and things like that, with their astronauts on a long-term space mission, like traveling to Mars at this point would be. Which I think is interesting, but I also find it interesting that all
are
the
U.S. saying that the Chinese are wanting to build a space Ferris wheel to go to Mars with? Is that
so, according to this article, which is out of the BBC Science Focus magazine, it says, it's about ambition, long-term thinking, and instilling a sense of purpose, such as long-haul thinking does not fit well with shorter-term Western thinking. Meaning that we're going to build this thing and spin it in space to perfect building long-range spacecraft.
So they want to take a Ferris wheel to Mars.
Basically.
That sounds a little crazy.
But
hey, man, if it works, I think it's exciting.
I think it's less crazy than you would think, though. I think they're testing some scientific principles to see, one, to see if they can do it, and two, to see if they can spin it.
I think that's the crucial first
Well,
step.
And I think, you know, although China has a very successful space program, I think they're one, you know, this is the Cold War has moved from U.S. and Russia to U.S. and China, and this is a Cold War response in the colonization of space and the militarization of space, you know, which is between Russia, the United States, and China at this point. Well, I think we'll cut it off there. Let us know what you think. Wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving, all of our listeners. Please be safe. Send us some feedback at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.